Nau mai, haere mai, and welcome to Full Disclosure, a Stuff and KL Productions podcast with me, Karen O'Leary. In this series, I talk with all sorts of amazing and famous Kiwis to find out how coming out was for them. This week on Full Disclosure, I talk to the amazing Elizabeth Kirikiri.
I'm lesbian femme. If I don't come out, people assume I'm straight, which is a real annoyance to me. So I used to come out all the time, purposely, mindfully, not let anyone assume I was straight and not let anyone assume that if I was with a guy, that was my partner.
How did you purposely come out? Did you just make a point of announcing it to anyone, everyone?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I did. I was relentless.
Well, hello. And I'm very excited to be joined today by the amazing, the fantastic, the activist, the wahine toa that is Elizabeth Kirikiri. How are you today, Elizabeth? Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, wonderful. It's so lovely to be with you.
Obviously, I was talking to you just before we started this amazing chat, and you've been somewhere a little bit warmer just recently. Where have you been, Elizabeth?
I was asked to speak at a conference in Mauritius. And as we say, if you must speak at a conference on a tropical island during our winter is a good way to go. Incredible activists that we met with, and just a sense of how lucky we are in this country, but how much more there is to do.
And in terms of that, what conference was it and what are you alluding to?
This is the Pan-Africa ILGA, so the International Body for Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Trans, Intersex and Queer People. And we in Aotearoa are part of ILGA Oceania. So my organisation, Te Whana Whana, is a member of that. So it was pretty wonderful to go up and meet activists from all across Africa.
Wow, and obviously, I mean, you have been an activist for, I'd say probably forever, for your whole life, but certainly a very visible and someone that has cared deeply about these things for a very long time. And we will talk about that a little bit later on. But obviously first, let's just start with just you, you know? And obviously this podcast is about people talking about their sexuality. So how would you define your sexuality?
When I first came out, I used the word lesbian, mm-hmm. a word I didn't hear till I was about 16 years old, and thought, that's me. But when I was a little bit older and heard the word takatāpui, mm-hmm. I realised that's more me. And so I use them in different contexts, but always promoting the recognition of the term takatāpui, a traditional term we've reclaimed to incorporate all of our whānau with diverse gender, sexualities and sex characteristics. So I'll say takatāpui, who's lesbian femme.
I reckon that's a great definition. And I noticed you mentioned then that you didn't hear the word lesbian until you were 16. I remember the first time I heard it, I was 5, and it was after watching the Top Twins, but you were 16. Do you remember the context in which you heard the word?
It was at high school. I'm a bit older than you, quite a bit older.
Only a smidge.
And it was that thing where everybody's swapping terms and words around, and people were just like, oh, somebody's a lesbian, and like, what does that mean? Yeah. And then as soon as I heard it, I thought, oh, I think that's me. So I didn't have a lot of dissonance when I came out. Once I had a language for it and knowledge of it, I was also aware from around 15, 16, 17 of same-sex couples because I met them through activist circles. So it would have actually been 15, 16 that I heard the term.
So you were already in your activist circles at 15, 16.
Mm.
Where do you think your passion for activism came from?
I think it was a sense of feeling really keenly about the injustice in the world. I was brought up in a home where there was violence and alcohol, and a lot of my friends were experiencing the same thing I was. We're in very unsafe situations as young people. Mm-hmm. And it was very obvious the racism that many of us were experiencing growing up as we did in Dunedin. And so even though there are amazing things about that place and I have such good memories of it, that's one of the things that kind of spiked my passion. And then I met with amazing people and connected up with a whole lot of different issues. So for us as young people, just being young, as students, as being women, but also as Māori, as Pacifica, and then the kaupapa itself, nuclear-free, independent Pacific, the Springbok tour, all sorts of things that were happening, homosexual law reform when I was a young person. And so all of those things, I grew up into a space of a hotbed of activism, but a way of working that said out what was our relationship as Māori to our Pacific Island whānau, our whanaunga, but also with other movements? How do we weave our efforts together? Because each of our groups might have been small, but we would always defer to the leadership of a particular group, and all of us would come to support each other. And that woven way of working has stood by me the entire life of my activism.
It's like sometimes, well, I'd say generally speaking, collaboration tends to work a lot better than competition, I would say.
Yes. When you're trying to create change, I always say that even if we might have slight differences in how we want to get there, if we have a shared vision, if we have that clarity, and I think that's the absolute core of what drives me, is I know what my job is here on this planet, and I know what's my contribution, and I just get on with it.
And you do that very, very well, I would argue.
Thank you.
Well, I won't argue with you, not at this stage. I might argue with you a bit later on, depending on what you say to me. No, okay. I won't. Although I am going to go back to competition, because I just also wanted to talk about one of the times that we did spend together back in 2002. We were competing for gold at the Olympic Games.
We were robbed.
We were absolutely robbed. And for people listening and who are thinking, I never knew that Karen O'Leary or Elizabeth Kirikiri went to the Olympic Games. Well, you've learned something new. Also, I guess officially it was the Gay Games in Sydney in 2002, wasn't it? Not the actual Olympics.
Yes.
But wasn't that a good time?
It was incredible time. It was just amazing. My wife, Alofa, and I went to the Amsterdam Gay Games, and we're crossing through the stadium and just had 50,000 people in the stands. And we said, we've got to bring all of our people to the next one, knowing it was in Sydney. So I spent the next 4 years helping fundraise and organising Team Wellington and bringing our crew through. And can I say, there is a set of photos of our different whānau in our passage as you walk into a house. And one of those is of Purple Ferns with you in that photo that sits on our mantelpiece as you walk into our house.
Aww.
So just FYI, it was a glorious time.
And just OOI, which is out of interest. Do I look pretty much exactly the same as I did in 2002?
Oh, exactly the same.
Yes. So do you, actually, to be fair. You definitely look exactly the same. Right, let's go back again to the start kind of thing. So obviously, once you had the terminology and the language to know who you were as a person or how you were feeling, when do you think you first had an inkling of maybe, I guess, and it is a point of difference. When did you ever think about that as a younger child? Or was it just really getting to that point when you're 15, 16?
I've always had a sense of myself of being different, always. Mm. And I was brought up around a lot of extremes. So my mother was the only Pākehā at any of our marae. Mm. So we were the only kids, our cousins, who were fair.
Yeah.
But when we were in Dunedin, our father was one of the few Māori, and we got called Hōrīs, and people tried to beat us up on the street. So we knew as young people never to go out by ourselves, we'd get a hiding. So that kind of very visceral, obvious racism that we experienced as young people, it made us really tight, really close. We always, but we had to be prepared to defend ourselves at a given time. So it was so weird to be too fair in one place but too dark somewhere else. I was always brought up by especially my father, I was the eldest, to get a good education. So I knew from a very young age that I would go to university. And I was one of the few in my family who, by the time I did go, had already gone. Only a couple of my older cousins across our wider whānau had been there. I was the first, you know, subsequently to get a PhD, first in our whole wider whānau to come into Parliament. So there were things where my father had a very high expectations of what I would do. And so, again, that made me really different. And our whānau, that I had real clarity. I also apparently at 7 said that I'd never get married to a man.
Wow.
Yeah. And one of the reasons was I liked my own name too much and I wasn't going to take anybody else's. So that turned out to be a bit of a prophecy.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because you didn't take Alofa's name, did you?
No, I did not. Our last names are already hard enough for people to say, let alone to hyphenate them.
I think you should have done it just on purpose.
Oh, I know. We did have that conversation. It's like, kere kere ayono kere kere, too hard.
So when you realised that this was who you were, who did you tell about it? Did you tell anyone? Did you announce it to anyone? Or was it just something that just became part of who you were?
It wasn't a big announcement. And as we know, coming out is a process. It's a gradual thing, and you come out over and over. The way you decide, are you going to correct somebody who's making false assumptions?
Yes.
When I first thought, we only knew of one local lesbian, and that was Yoko Newman in Dunedin, who I just went to talk to and say, you know, I didn't want to claim something that wasn't mine. And so I went to talk to her and say, so I think I might be this thing that you are as well. Am I? Is that correct? And so we just had a simple conversation. I thought, okay, then. So as I say, no dissonance, no, oh my God, this is such a big thing. It wasn't. It was like, oh, cool. Now I have a name for it. I have a clarity around it. Then I'm all good. I told my family, and I remember one of my sisters going, oh, great, you're already a radical, and now you're going to be a lesbian. It's just typical. And so it took me a while longer to tell my father, another 2 years, because he'd said really homophobic things in the past.
Right.
But again, he'd brought me up to be strong. He raised me to not suffer idiots and to respect people who stood their ground.
Yeah.
And so I decided, right, as I say, I was prepared to take the hiding, but this is who I was, and I needed him not only to know about it, but I needed him to support me. And so that's what I said to him, and he said, okay, fine. No big dramas, no big conversation. He just looked at me and went, are you sure? And I went, yes. And he goes, then fine, I'll support you.
Wow.
And it was because I was prepared to stand up to him, and I was prepared to take whatever was coming if he didn't like it. And it meant also that Dad treated me differently, and he protected me across our whole family. I have cousins who are a lesbian or who have transitioned, and their whānau didn't support because their father didn't support, whereas my father did. And by giving that support, gave me protection.
Yeah. And then when you got a bit older, so I say in your early 20s, it sounds like you didn't have that, there was no dissonance or anything like that. So did you ever feel like, do you feel like your sexuality is a big part of who you are, a small part of who you are? Is it just something that exists within you? Like, how would you sort of define that kind of thing?
I think it's a core part of who I am, and it can't be separated from everything else.
Yeah.
Because when I was a young activist, then it was all about the language, it was about the land, it was about the different politics we're involved in, and sexuality wasn't the big issue.
Mm.
But as I got older, into my 20s, I moved to Wellington, and I realised, actually, there's a lot of discrimination that comes by just being this sexuality.
Yeah.
Now, I'm lesbian femme. If I don't come out, people assume I'm straight, which is a real annoyance to me. So I used to come out all the time, like purposely, mindfully, not let anyone assume I was straight, and not let anyone assume that if I was with a guy, that was my partner.
And how did you purposely come out? Did you just make a point of announcing it to anyone, everyone?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I did. I was relentless. Yeah. They would, especially if they said, oh, is this your husband or this is your boyfriend? Because that happened all the time.
Yeah.
And I'd go, no, because I'm not heterosexual. I'm a lesbian. And so I would say that over and over.
What was the general response you'd get?
Shock.
Yeah.
Because they'd look at me and... Now, if you're during the day and you're in a generally safe space, you could got away without too much risk. But I would also do that when people were drinking late at night, and some men didn't think that that was acceptable, that I was that thing, that they thought that they could turn me, change me.
Oh.
And so I still did that because a little bit outrageous.
Yes, I know that about you.
But I used to also do things like when I was younger, and it was a real thing to try and stop men calling us girls.
Mm.
And I used to say, I'm not a girl, I'm a fully menstruating woman. And that was very upsetting to people, to men, because it's like,
it's just too shocking. You're not supposed to say that word, Elizabeth.
So every single time I got called a girl, because it was done in a demeaning way.
Yeah,
you know, now girl has taken on a new way of being used in today's context. But back then it was a put down. Mm. It was like, hey, little girl, just be quiet. Yeah. I was like, yeah, I'm not going to be quiet.
No, I don't think it suits you, to be honest.
It really doesn't.
But it's because you've got so many good things to say.
Yeah, you know? It always astounds me when people think they can keep me quiet.
Look, I'm speechless. No. obviously you've mentioned Alofa a couple of times and she's fantastic and I think she's really, really funny and just really lovely. Can you tell me a bit about when you guys got together?
We got together back in 1992. So we've been together in February. It'll be 32 years.
So good.
So good and so happy. We had both been going to events in something called, it was LARF, the Lesbian Activity and Recreation Festival. Mm-hmm. And her and I had been going to different things. And on the last day, we're out at Makara Beach, really wild beach outside of Wellington. Yes. And I'd gone to meet my friends. And now I'd seen Alofa the night before. It was the dance out at what was called Outrage at the time.
Yeah.
Yes. And I'd seen her, but I didn't talk to her. And so I'd gone to meet my friends. They weren't there. I was just about to leave. I turned around and there was Alofa walking up with one of my friends. So I pretended I'd just arrived and went to say hello.
Genius.
And so then we went into the little cafe that's there. People were just playing games and I was reading with one of my mates and she was playing ping pong and she kept hitting the ball over to me and I thought nothing of it. It's such a typical butch thing, but I thought nothing of it. I thought, obviously, she's not very good at this game. And she kept hitting it over to me, so she had to come over to me and pick up the ball from around me over and over again.
Yeah.
And then everyone moved to sit at the table, and we had this giant game of Chinese checkers. Mm. And there was just this point at which she said, so many colours, and I looked at her and I said, so little time. And we just clicked. But what was crazy is at that very moment where we looked at each other, someone took a photo of us. So we have a photo of the moment that we clicked. And
that is amazing.
Yeah. It was pretty wild. And we were those, the jokes that people tell about lesbians. We got together 2 weeks later, moved in, never been apart.
Well, I just think that's a beautiful love story. And I love love stories, so that's fantastic.
Yeah, no, she's pretty awesome.
She is pretty awesome. You both are.
I think you're conflating a whole bunch of issues.
You don't want to be held to account rising child abuse numbers.
You can manipulate crime statistics.
I promised I wouldn't have a tattoo about gotcha journalism.
Hang into the National Party's attack line there.
It would be a resignation offence if I didn't deliver tax reduction.
I'm not worried about it at all.
Nothing iffy in there. That sits with you perfectly fine.
That's what we're focused on.
Whatever happens in politics, the weird, the wonderful, the important, the thought-provoking, we got you. Listen to Tova wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's talk about the homosexual law reform that happened in 1986. How old were you then? Then we're going to be able to work out how old you are, so if you don't want to say. But
But
I think the internet tells people everything anyway.
It really does. So actually, how old was I? 86, I would have been 21. But of course, the lobbying for that started well before then.
And so what was your involvement in that like?
So I was not a leader in that. I was supporting our local lesbian and gay group from our other political groups as Māori women's groups and our Young Pacifica groups and as the Māori Students Association and the big march that we had in Dunedin. I was holding a megaphone. There's a TV clip of us coming over this little rise and I'm leading the march, calling out, doing the chants. But in terms of leadership, no. And in fact, I will remember when that march went through town and I was quite shocked at on the sideline to see my nana and granddad on the street watching in astonishment this march coming past, because it was huge. It was so many people.
Yeah.
The other thing we did, some of my mentors took me up to Wellington and they'd arranged a meeting with Fran Wild. And so I actually went to Parliament with them, and that was for them to talk about the Māori issues that were impacting on people who were lesbian and gay at that time. And I have to say that it was very much focused on lesbian gay. The law was very specific to gay men, but of course it impacted. But just want to acknowledge trans people, non-binary people, intersex people who were all part of that work.
Yeah.
The other thing that was really telling, and the thing that happens when you stay in the work for a very long time, was all of the churches were against homosexual law reform, all except, I believe, the Unitarian Church. and to be part of putting conversion practices through law in Parliament this term, and to see nearly every single mainstream church coming in behind it. It's a very healing thing for people of faith. But at that time, the churches were solidly against this reform. And in fact, the public was as well. It was remarkable the way that they got it through Parliament. Remarkable. Huge amount of work.
Yeah, and I guess like you're talking about, you know, that shift that, you know, hopefully does happen over time, you know, in terms of the conversion therapy, you know, getting banned and all that kind of stuff. I guess, would you say that activism and having people just standing up for the things that they believe in and the things that they believe are right, is that kind of the key component of achieving or affecting positive change?
I believe it's completely essential. Change happens at many different levels, but changing the will of the people, I believe, is created through activism, that you create a groundswell, you make people have the conversation. When I look at something, so our parties inside Parliament, we're the very blunt end of change, the passing the law. We can pass law, but if the groundwork isn't happening, the law doesn't make a lot of difference in people's actual lives.
So true, yeah.
So we look at the example of marriage equality. Now, that flew through Parliament only because the hard work had happened with civil union acts, the big protests, the ugliness, the fights, the was horrible during that time. That had already happened, and mainstream New Zealand looked at that and said, this is not who we are. Actually, it doesn't hurt anybody else to allow same-sex marriage to happen. At that time, civil union, that's when Lawfer and I had ours.
Yeah.
And so by the time it got to marriage equality, it was much more of a formality. It's that the whole country had moved.
Yeah, and those conversations had been had.
Exactly. And that's what the activism does. That's what marching in the street does. It's the people coming up to Parliament and saying, politicians, you must do this thing. It's getting on the news and people going, what's actually happening? What are the actual issues? What does this mean in our community? And that's one thing I'm also really thankful for. Those early activist days, is we would do things like stand on the street and talk to people. When everybody did the big hikoi to Waitangi in 1984, we said, well, we could go up there and we can be part of that. That changes nothing in Dunedin. So we committed that we would stay and we would stop Pākehā people on the streets of Dunedin and try and talk to them about the treaty.
Wow.
It was...
did it work?
Again, having the conversation.
Yeah.
I believe it contributes to it. So in the same way, say for conversion practices, when I did my petition, 160,000 signatures in 1 week, by far breaking all records in our country. And you know, that led to this law being sped up and going through. Yeah. But on the ground, it's speaking to those people. And I look at people like my mother and my godmother, Erin Kerekere, and Susan Thompson, and they were active members of PFLAG, Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gays. Mm-hmm. And they went and talked to different church people across Dunedin as part of their work. So that work on the ground, talking to people, having the conversations, creates that bigger change. And they might not call that activism, but actually they're getting in there and they're advocating. At least it's advocacy.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we need all of those things, all of those elements, the big splashy stuff, but in the end, those conversations, thousands of those conversations.
What would you say to the, and I've got my fingers up like quotation marks while I say the word, activists that spend a lot of time in those holes that have been dug by rabbits and just sit on a computer and just send horrible things around the universe? What would you say to those activists, again in quotation marks, because they're obviously not? Are they anti-activists? Well, no, they are of sorts, I guess, that they want to, and you talk to it because you know all of this stuff and you're very, very and you know my point, are you getting what you know what I'm getting at? Yeah.
So I'd say they're definitely not activists.
Good.
That they're not creating or contributing to any kind of conditions that will create change. They're just detracting for the sake of causing turmoil, of distrust, because when you start to create distrust in our institutions, then those institutions lose their power to actually fix things and make things right. It's very easy to sit on a computer and have a code name and put your ugliness out into the world. We have to be really, really vigilant for real activists, people creating real change and actually wanting to improve people's lives and give people rights, which they're already allowed and should have, but do not. We have to be vigilant against that disinformation, the misinformation that can trap people. Because while some people are mindful and they are doing it on purpose, there are people who get lost in a rabbit hole.
Yes.
Yeah. Who have actually been groomed to do that. It's quite freaky when you read how, you know, how people are guided into that rabbit hole. That's they don't get there by accident. That's just the nature of it. And you just have to care for people and check that people are okay within that space. But the ones who are causing hate, no.
Yeah.
Not acceptable.
But can activism help to improve that situation?
Part of activism is spreading correct information.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
It's making sure that when you're looking for information on a topic, go to credible sources. The way that the internet now, social media, has done it conflates all news as being equal. Now, it used to be, it's very obvious what's on credible TV, credible news sources, and what's just someone's opinion. Nowadays, really hard to tell them apart.
Yeah.
So very I think helping people understand that, putting out the good news, swamping the misinformation.
Yes.
Is what, and activism is key for that.
Now, speaking of good information, what advice would you, A, give to your younger self, if you have any advice for your younger self, but then also what advice would you give to young people today who are part of the rainbow community?
I'm fortunate to be in a position where I do give advice to the young to people in our community. I write resources, I write, give out tips on relationships, about being takatāpui. I think my younger self, it's, just to keep going. It does get better, that it's worth it. It's worth it to stay. Yeah. Because there were pretty hairy times in my youth. I wasn't sure I'd be staying around. And yeah, it's worth it to stay.
Well, Elizabeth, I am so glad that you did stay. Now, just before we wrap it up, I was wondering, going back to the amazing ILGA conference that you were in lovely Mauritius, what were the main talking points at the conference?
A core part of the conference is about how ILGA, Pan-Africa ILGA, are organising themselves. And so what are the key issues that are happening for them? They've had really repressive laws in that area, some of them quite recent, like we've seen in Uganda. So it's sharing advice about how to look after each other, good processes, strategies, tactics for people to use to create safety and change. I came over to be part of what was called a Mapping Desire workshop, but it is looking at our sexuality and saying, how have we come to where we are? So actually, some of the questions you started off with were some of the things that we talked about. And actually owning our sexuality is a core part of who we are. That's something that's often neglected. We talk about diverse sexualities, but we only use it in terms of identity, as opposed to how, what does that look like in terms of our relationships, and how we share ourselves, who we're intimate with, and how that all works out. So so I shared some of the story again about Lofer and I, how we got together.
It's a really good story. A
bit more detail too about some of the difficulties from when I was younger and some of the ways, because sometimes when we experience trauma when we're young, and that plays out into our relationships. And I think coming back to your question about advice for young people, it's one of the things that I'm really staunch about, is to help and to try and work through the trauma we have, so that we bring our best selves to our relationships and to our organisations and to our activism, because trauma is so common in our communities, and we have to acknowledge that sometimes it can impact negatively on our, on ourselves, on our relationships and our work. But rising above that, addressing those issues, makes us powerful.
Absolutely. And just in terms of, you know, obviously I you're making these amazing resources. Where can people access these things, Elizabeth?
The original Taka Taupui, part of the whānau resource, the Mental Health Foundation has the first one. Mm-hmm. And yeah. The second one, Growing Up Taka Taupui, Whānau Journeys, is at Rainbow Youth. So this, and I'm actually about to write the third, which is going to be about gender affirming healthcare.
Good on you, Elizabeth. And also, thank you so, so much. Honestly, you are such an inspiration, and the work that you do does make such a positive difference to so many people. So, just from me to you, thank you so much. But I know that that thanks would come from so many people around Aotearoa. So, keep up the amazing work that you do. And thank you so much for talking to me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much. It's always lovely to catch up with you.
I'm going to come to Gisborne for a beer, okay?
Please.
All right. Leave it with me. I'm coming in summer, remember? This was Full Disclosure, a Stuff and KL Productions podcast. Thanks so much for listening. There's a new episode released every Tuesday. You can find them at stuff.co.nz/full disclosure or wherever you get your podcasts. If you follow us on Apple or Spotify or any of the podcast apps, you'll get the latest episode delivered automatically without lifting a finger. Thanks to creator and producer Kate Langdon, Stuff producer Jen Black, and executive producer Chris Reed, and audio editor John Ropiha, with original music by Eilish Wilson. Mā te wā, Aotearoa.
If you don't have time to read the in-depth stories, or you just prefer to listen instead, The Long Read from Stuff is the podcast for you. Each week we showcase one of our excellent pieces of journalism, telling important or entertaining stories from the world of crime, sport, history, culture, and more. You also get to hear from the journalists themselves about how they uncovered the story and how it came to life. So, for your weekly dose of long-form journalism, beautifully read, subscribe to The Long Read from Stuff wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Chris.
Yes?
Do you want another very broad question? I've got a very broad question today.
Go on, then.
What do you know about sports?
Up the Wazz! Go the Black Caps! And don't forget Premier League football.
Oh, you do love a bit of Premier League footy, don't you? What team is it that you support again?
Oh, the current champions, Manchester City.
I think they're pronounced Arsenal. It's pronounced Arsenal.
But you know what's good about football?
What?
They don't regulate sock height.
I'm sorry? There's a sport that regulates sock height?
Indeed there is, and it's cycling.
That's very strange. Why on earth do they regulate it?
Well, I know, but if you want to find out, you'll have to listen to the Big Stuff Quiz, wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, that's a cliffhanger indeed. The Big Stuff Quiz is brought to you by Melbourne Every Bit Different.